I do remember Fern Gully. I like the idea.
Why should I worry? Why should I care?
That's not the song I think about when I think of Fern Gully.
It's Oliver and Company.
Good movie, though. Ophelia goes ahead and takes, you know, a bath, but she just, you know, shuts the doors and then she pulls out the book and the stones and she reads what her first task is.
Okay, every time Ophelia opens a book in this film, she opens it in the middle of the book. She never starts at the top. She never, when she opens the book to show the fairy the picture of a fairy, she opens it directly to the fairy page. I mean, does nobody appreciate a preface or a title page anymore? Does nobody care about the index glossaries or?
I don't know if that's like the highlight of her book experience. If you have an instruction book, you should really start at the beginning. Not unless someone's like, hey, here's a book of stuff that you need to do and I bookmarked it for you.
Yeah, there's a bookmark. Mm-hmm. She's just willy-nilly picking a page.
To be fair, there isn't anything in that book the first time she opens it. And when she does open it, it does give her the, I think it's supposed to be like a magic book that, you know, it recognizes where she's opened it and just sort of gives her the information.
It is a tool to get to the next scene of whatever she's going to be doing.
Right. So Mercedes is downstairs cutting up food, getting ready for the party. And she does this interesting thing with the knife that she's using. She wipes it on her apron and then kind of folds it.
Yes. Just so she repeatedly it through the film.
Yeah. This is a habit that she has gotten into. And then everybody sees Ophelia come down in this pretty green dress with a white frock, white apron. Yeah.
All of Alice in Wonderland. It's pretty standard little girl 1940 attire.
Alice in Wonderland, ladies and gentlemen.
I might reference that on occasion.
No, it's not that. It's just, it kind of like speaks to the film too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, was all of that in Alice's head? I don't know. And so
everyone coos over her. And then she says, then Mercedes offers the grossest beverage.
Honey with milk.
Yeah, warm milk with honey. And she's like, oh, yes, I would like that.
I don't know if honey and milk would be, like, have you ever had, like, they're not graham crackers, but there's, like, a cereal out there.
Like honeycomb?
Not honeycomb, but it's, like, graham crackers with some sweet stuff in it. And then when you drink the milk, it tastes a little like
golden
sweet.
Grams.
Gold. Thank you. It's golden grams. And then when you drink the milk afterwards, it always tasted really good to me. So the idea of milk and honey on its own does not necessarily put me off.
If they had left it without a visual.
The visual is Mercedes milking a cow.
Which isn't wrong. It's just that I live in a homogenized society where somebody uses a machine to get that milk, cleans that milk, pasteurizes that milk, ships that milk out to me. I pay $2.79 for a gallon of it. And that 2% pleasure is mine.
And then if you wanted to add honey to it, I've never tried that. Maybe I should try it just to see. I had a lemon chocolate bar the other day, and it is delicious. It's like milk chocolate and lemon, and it tastes kind of like an orange chocolate bar. It's kind of got that citrusy, but it's not like overbearing, but it's delicious. And you wouldn't think lemon and chocolate. Would that work? Yes.
Dark chocolate and lemon is one of my favorite flavor combinations of all time.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I'm for you. I support you. We should eat that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Mercedes gives Ophelia, we don't actually see Ophelia drink, kind of just cuts to Ophelia.
Oh, shocked. She didn't want to put that in her mouth. I'm saying that you see the teat, you hear it go in the bucket, she scoops it out, it's got lumps in it. Lumps, Lydia. When's the last time you drank something with lumps in it? And when's the last time you heard a beverage full of lumps and you were like, that sounds enticing?
Bubble tea?
No, I would eat bubble tea.
Doesn't that have lumps in it?
It does. That's the tapioca pearls, but like, that's a vegetable.
Okay. So
we're talking protein fat chunks.
And that stuff comes out lumpy, even if it's cold, which warm milk by itself is kind of gross for me. You got to add something to it, you know, like chocolate or cinnamon or both. But like lumpy cold milk is probably just as appealing as warm, lumpy milk.
Straight from the teat. Okay. Anyways, this scene is not all about feeding a child milk. It's about the fact that Ophelia feels like she can open up to Mercedes about the fantastical things that are helping her. But they don't get to have a really long conversation. Nobody ever has a long conversation in this film.
They gotta get the story going. It's already like close to 2 hours.
Yeah. just like this podcast. So all that Mercedes really can say is that her mom told her to be wary of fawns. So there's this, that's where I think Ophelia gets the largest amount of her doubt for the rest of the film. Like, the reason she questions him so much is because, and it's good that she does.
Yeah, it is. And it ends up being like important in later on. But Mercedes is kind of like, again, spoilers, Mercedes is working for the rebels and kind of goes to this line, which I think is one of the best lines in the movie. It's about, like, you know, challenging or questioning people who paint themselves up as authorities. Mm. And, you know, it's that little seed that gets put into Ophelia's mind that is like, should I be trusting this fawn?
Ophelia and Mercedes are like practically the same person to me, just an adult version, right, a child version.
Right.
So there's this curious disobedience is what I think I heard it phrased on the internet. So you're like, what is this? How does this work? How can this benefit me? I'm going to do something that I might have been told not to do because, you know, because I'm curious and or there's something that I need and it's worth the risk. Ophelia is the innocent side of that. And then Mercedes is the world-worn version of that.
Right, right. And there's definitely a lot of things that you can compare between Ophelia and Mercedes. Mm. Just throughout the entire movie. I mean, their relationship with the captain, they kind of have this idea that some in the film would consider to be a little fantastical. It's not necessarily tangible. It may not be real, but it's real enough for them to...
I mean, it shared hardship increases intimacy, as I always mm-hmm. say, since I stole it from, what was that show? Dharma and Greg. Oh, God. Okay, sorry. Mental break from what we're actually talking about. But Dharma and Greg was amazing, and I loved that show. And there's the one episode where they have to peel potatoes together at a commune or a couples retreat or something. And they're like, they say we have to do this because shared hardship increases intimacy. And then like, I was like, oh, nope, that's right. That's a life lesson. Thanks, Dharma Greg. Mm-hmm. Sorry. So anyways, Mercedes is called away from this conversation.
Right. And Ophelia goes out into the woods with the task at hand. The first task that she has to do is go into a tree, a dying tree, and put stones into the mouth of a frog that is ultimately kind of killing the tree. And so she takes the stones and her nice dress and takes that out into the woods where she can find the tree and then find the frog and
complete her first task.
Right.
So she has enough foresight to take off the dress.
Right.
Oh, but we just passed over the part where Mercedes walks over to the barn where they're storing. She's called over to store the stuff and hand over the key so that nobody has access to the barn. And there's only one key, blah, blah, blah. That's not what's important. We learn that that's where all the stuff is. And we learn that there's only one key, air quotes, in there.
It's pretty much, the storage is pretty much a plot device.
We're just establishing a location we'll need later. The guy in the Star Wars hat happens at this point.
Yeah, you talked about that hat.
It's just this black plastic looking hat that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't look like anybody else's hat. It doesn't serve any purpose greater than another person's hat. All I can do is stare at it whenever it's on screen.
If there is a purpose and some like Spanish historian would like to tell us about the purpose of that hat, feel free to do so.
Goodness. I'm sure I have at least one or two costume buff friends from college, and they'll just be like, you know, in 1944, that hat was invented because it distracts the mosquitoes from superior officers.
And so...
Sorry, we can get back under the tree with the girl.
Well, I think before trying to make sure... Oh, okay. So while Ophelia is making her way into the woods, the captain is informed that there are... is this the point where they see the smoke rising?
Yes,
from,
yes.
Like, in right. the middle of the day, smoke is rising from someplace.
It's like a quarter mile away from them.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they needed to stop for something, but still, it's like, couldn't it have waited until you got to your cave? Anyways.
Yeah. If you have read The Hunger Games, or you have... I haven't read them. I've only seen the movie. But if you are a fan of survival stuff mm-hmm. and you're eluding somebody who's in pursuit of you, mm-hmm. my side of the mountain, whatever style you got to this knowledge, most of us who are super paranoid about eluding people in the woods would know not to light a fire.
Whether, I mean, maybe during the day, but even still, they're going to see the smoke. I did actually listen to the audiobook for The Hunger Games, and that was like a huge point. Like, Katniss was just like the stupid person who's lighting a fire in the middle of the night, and they are right underneath me. Maybe I should take them out. And it was like a big point in the book. And so you are very correct.
Thank you. And I believe you are correct as well.
You are validated.
We are both correct. We're going to include Jonathan on being correct on that.
Okay, so the
cat... they're off and running towards the smoke coming out of the woods.
And Ophelia is learning about what she has to do, the tale of the tree, and what she has to do with it. And can't remember which comes first. If it's... I believe it's Ophelia gets to the tree, takes off her dress. Her shoes are really muddy. And that's kind of like, oh, my shoes are muddy. I should take off this dress because it's really important to my mom.
Yeah, so when she climbs into the tree, she's only wearing her slip.
Right. And she gets in there and there's all of these like gross bugs that are crawling all over her.
Oh, I wrote down CGI bugs for the win.
Yeah, they also become important later on when she meets the frog. And then it like kind of cuts back to the captain.
Where he's standing at the fire, can I just say that they've seen the smoke. They walk up to the bed of, it's smoking. It's smoking charcoal. And mm-hmm. he like puts his hands over it. They've been here in the last 20 minutes. And I'm like, child, you know they were because you got smoke and embers. They're okay. Like right in front of you. Like there was no unclear evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's some sort of discernible skill in how long a fire has been abandoned.
Maybe in 1944, they just didn't have anything else to do. And so like timing fires... Again, no Twitter, no YouTube.
They didn't have fancy latex paint to watch dry, so you just gotta watch the fire.
Yeah, and you gotta like figure that out. You're counting. But they also find this little vial of what could be medicine.
Antibiotics. Except said with like this gorgeous Spanish accent.
Yes.
Antibiotics.
And then the guy behind him is like a lottery ticket. And I was, in my mind, I'm thinking, ooh, a lottery ticket.
It actually serves the plot later on.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
At first I was like, well, that's stupid. And then when it mm-hmm. got, when there was a callback to it, I was like, that's not as stupid. But so Captain V for Vendetta, whatever. Captain is just like, they're here. And he's just like, because he's always talking in a lower octave. Mm-hmm. It's actually a stage direction he was given to talk in a lower octave. But this is the one time he gets really loud. And he's like, you dropped something or something like that, right?
Yeah. I could probably like pull up the scene on my phone because
it doesn't matter because they don't come out and he's just taunting them, which isn't really okay. But then he like goes away. And this is where my notes say, smoking hot rebels, by the way, because the second he goes away, all of them step out from behind whatever tree they're standing behind, and they're like mm-hmm. beautiful brown outfits, and they're...
When is a rebel not attractive?
This is a question for the ages, because mm-hmm. they are attractive.
Mm-hmm. Because they're rebels.
Okay, first of all, they're on the right side of the right side of history, right? Mm-hmm. They are fighting for justice and equality. They don't have time to shave every day. Their clothing needs to be casual, comfortable, but close-fitting for... So many reasons, like escape and for transportation and all that. Comfortable walking shoes, so you know they're getting some exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Pedro. Oh, my God. We'll get to Pedro, okay. But Pedro.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, put a pin in Pedro.
I mean... Don't...
If it's consensual, pin.
Outtakes.
No. Like the uncut episodes, like the I can't imagine somebody sitting and listening to this for like 3 hours unedited, right? Like I just can't imagine it. So I imagine imagine if they were, like, I would call it something like, we didn't want our parents to hear.
That's perfect, though. That is perfect. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Smoking hot rebels. But they only cut to them. They show them and their hotness, and then they cut away.
Right. So Ophelia is back down in the muddy area, and she's crawling, and she's covered in more mud. And before we cut away from her the first time, we see this bug crawling up on her arm, and she wipes it away, but her hands are all muddy. And so she's like, she's dirty, and it's kind of in this way of like, bugs have been crawling up on her, and then she's been shooing them away. She's covered in mud. And then we get the frog, and she chastises the frog for pretty much just like having a really crappy life.
Don't you feel bad for being under this tree and killing it?
No, for the record, I am a frog. These bugs are delicious.
And so the frog grabs one of the bugs that crawled up onto her face.
The big wet slimy Guillermo, whoever made this decision, they used a lot of the aloe vera gel that's really stringy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? So like this is when like your face gets licked and it's like it's so gross.
Yeah.
But then but she's like, oh, easy. Oh, and then he belches in her face.
Yeah, and then I belched, by the way.
Yeah, when the second watching. He's going with a super long burp. Lydia's like over there and she goes burp.
And I just lose it because I wish I had. I mean, part of me wants to record when we're watching the movie because, like, I'm like, this is what I'm going to yell about later on. Or just something falls out. That's really good during the watching. Okay, so we are past the thing where it. Oh, so let's just cut through this pretty quick. She tricks him into eating. She picks up a bug and is like, "You want to eat this bug?" He's like, "Hell yeah, I want to eat this bug." She holds up like a handful of bug shaped objects and that one bug she showed him. He like grabs the whole thing, four little pieces out of her hand. Three of those bugs. Actually, the rocks she was supposed to feed him.
He vomits up like raisin custard.
Yes, I called it the raisin cookie death.
Yeah, and she pulls out this golden key from that stuff. And then she walks out of the tree only to find that her dress, it fell off of the branch. She was really careful.
And it wasn't even just damp on one side. It looked like something had rolled around on it. It was fully penetrated with mud.
Rabbits.
Rabbits roll around on it. Sorry. So my notes go, dress ruined, of course. Rain.
Yeah.
Like, of course.
Right. And so she goes back. And at this point, we're seeing the party guests arrive and they're coming out into the rain, and then they go in and they have their nice dinner party.
They got that very much needed evil priest who's dismissing all the evils because his belly is full. And so obviously
he doesn't have to worry about the injustices of those who cannot take care of themselves. His exact line is, well, God saved their soul, so it doesn't matter what happens to their bodies.
God, he's such a piece of garbage.
I know. And he's like right close to the captain. So, and then there's a couple of.
Oh, they get touchy about like how somebody asks Carmen, how did you get together with the captain? And she seems more engaged to tell the story, but he kind of shuts her down.
Yeah. He's like, this is boring. That's what he tells everybody. He's like, she doesn't understand that, you know, not everybody wants to hear a boring story.
Yeah, but I feel like there's a subtext there that we don't get to see. Because, like, her late husband was the tailor to the captain. And then when he died in the war, then she got together with the captain. Mm-hmm. And since he died many years ago, like, that connection is unclear. But I will note that this movie... No, I'll save that for later. Mm-hmm. No, I'll tell it now. No holding back. This movie seems to be completely devoid of a romantic love interest on any character's part. I mean, I wanted it to be there for the captain and Carmen just to give the depth. But even if I take any kind of personal emotion out of it, like, I'm super proud of it not being romantic at all.
Right. It kind of just like doesn't go down that road, which is, it's a fairy tale. There's so many different moments in this that indicate it's a fairy tale, and yet it's not showing that romantic element, which, I mean, if you've ever read Grimm fairy tales, I wouldn't say a lot of them have a romantic element in them. I mean, there's definitely ones about, you know, like doing the right thing or just like don't go into the woods because the woods are scary.
Yeah. But this scene demonstrates something you pointed out earlier, which is she is the vessel for his baby. And that's all he really cares about. And why are you talking to my baby vessel about romantic stuff that doesn't really mean anything? She's right. Just the holder of my child. But then somebody comes in and is like, hey, Ophelia's back. And I realized something while watching it. I love when all of the men stand up when a woman enters or leaves a room. Like, I know it's old school. I know it doesn't matter at all. But, like, throwing a handkerchief to the ground doesn't mean anything to me.
Taking your coat, putting it over a puddle.
A tip of the hat, whatever. No. But there's something that is thoughtful and respectful about, like, standing. And I know it's just form because everybody does it in this scene. But I was like, oh.
Everybody stands up as Carmen leaves to go and see Ophelia because she's been missing. And now they found her and she came back. And so
you've really hurt me by messing up this dress.
But not as much as you hurt the captain. And Ophelia smiles after she gets chastised for, you know, hurting the captain. But before we actually get to that scene, the captain has a interesting exchange with someone who was like, oh, I met your father. And he once said that he smashed his watch. He said when he died, he wanted his watch to be smashed on a rock so that way his son would know what time his father died. And this seems like it's a family thing. But again, if it's a cultural thing, please let us know. Spanish historians, specifically acknowledged in the 1940s. Nice. Nice. Because the guy saying, I knew your father, and the captain hears this whole story and is asked, is there any truth to this watch being smashed so that way he would know what time his father died? And the captain's just like, that's ridiculous. My dad never had a watch. We have seen him with a watch.
I'm thinking like half of his corporals. He pulls it out every 20 seconds to check.
I know. And it's got this cracked face on it and everything. It's
distinctive and wise. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's just kind of another layer to his character where he's like kind of has this layer where he's not being honest about things. But it seems like when he gets challenged by the doctor about the if this baby's going to be a boy, he's just like, well, you. And then when he gets asked this question, just a very common question, he's kind of like...
He's in the business of shutting people down.
Right, right. And
it's so strange because you don't get a lot out of that one. You could wring that rag and nothing's going to come out of it. Like, he just doesn't seem like one to just give anything up.
Right. He doesn't seem like he wants to be vulnerable in any way possible. When someone asks him to show a layer of vulnerability, like with his father, or like with how do you know, that this baby is going to be a son, he's just sort of like,
yep, you're absolutely right. He's very much like a Ron Swanson in that moment, not to compare the two, but he's very much like he would have copied the line, I know what I'm about, son.
Is that from Parks and Rec?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. He's just a very stern character. And he's just like, he went into a hardware store and the guy's like, can I help you? And he's like, I know more than you.
He's kind of like the Black Knight from Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail. When someone cuts off his arm, he's just like, no, that's a flesh wound.
It's just flesh wound?
Yeah.
I'm with you. I like that. Okay. 100. Okay. So we go to the room. I'm so sorry you made out the dress, but the captain's even more upset. Okay. So Ophelia's in the bathtub again. And this is 1944. This is her, you know, she's getting her 6 month bathtub time, mm-hmm. 6 months early because she just took a bath.
They had to do it twice in one day.
Yeah, crazy. Mm-hmm. Decadence.
Yeah.
Just. But she, the mom says, you disappointed me today, but I'm much less disappointed than the captain is, which means she's not as mad as he is. And the daughter picks up on that and there's this little smirk. And you can tell, like, this little spark turns into, oh, I'm going to get away with some stuff right now.
Little rebel.
Yeah.
Which kind of reminds me of throughout the entire film, you every time they would say Ophelia, you were like, Ophelia was a daughter. Which...
I was like, who did that song? It was the Meredith...
Natalie Merchant.
And I still...
Okay, interesting point. Both of us had that album when we were younger.
Yeah.
It's such a good album.
It really was.
But I mean, when Ophelia is smiling about disappointing the captain, I was like looking up the lyrics to the song. And there is actually a line. Ophelia was a rebel girl, a blue stocking suffragette.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Such a good one. Anyways.
So then so she smirks in the bathtub. Twigsy shows up and she's like, take me to the labyrinth. And so she makes it a fourth time. What are we, fourth? Eighth?
Yeah. Yeah.
She's been there 25 times now. She just gets out of the house, goes to the labyrinth. And everybody's like, where are you off to? She's like, I'm off to the labyrinth. And like, unescorted? Yeah, sure. Like, alone in 1944? Uh-huh. Are there rebels in the area who are looking to hurt, harm, or cause struggle for people at the encampment that you're at? Yeah, no, it totally is. Have a lovely day, Miss Ophelia. Have a lovely day.
See, I love these exchanges where it's just you going back and forth. That's great. No, it's great. It's great. That is like comedy gold.
That's why I get so mad, though, because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it serves the plot, mm-hmm. that she can get in and out really fast. But I need a little... I mean, they spent time on stuff I don't care about. So they'll be like, no, I can't possibly. You cannot do that. And then they would cut to the next scene and they were doing exactly that.
Yeah.
And it was very much the, I beg you to reconsider.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So she's in the labyrinth.
Yeah. And she goes and tells the Fawn, I got the golden key.
Can we just note that he's eating something in this scene?
Flesh.
It looks like meat. And there's mm-hmm. just the most disturbing chewing noises.
Even Twigsy gets in on the action.
She goes to town. She's mm-hmm. like not scared. She bites the crack out of it. She's like, it was very, but the mouth noises.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
and so she's like, hey, I got the key. See, totally got it. And he was like, awesome.
You keep it.
Yeah. And I'm going to give you a piece of chalk. And he starts talking about the next trial and like being all flowery and stuff. She's like, why should I trust you? And he... He says, why would I lie?
I'm just a humble fawn.
Yeah.
Is that part?
Yeah. That's the part. That's the part. He's just like, I'm just a humble fawn. Why would I lie? What would I gain by lying to you about these tasks? This exchange between Ophelia and the fawn is, he's just a little bit creepy. And it kind of reminds me how the captain is with Mercedes in that very first scene where he's kind of like, you know, trying to be affectionate.
He does kind of pet her hair, doesn't
he? Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just sort of like a little bit creepy, but it kind of like this exchange, like there's a lot of parallels between Ophelia and Mercedes, but the way that Mercedes is treating the fawn in this scene.
Nope. Wait, Ophelia's treating the fawn?
In the way that Ophelia is responding to the fawn in this scene,
yeah.
It feels a little similar to the way that Mercedes responds to the captain.
Because she's guarded.
Yeah.
Because she's not exactly sure about his objective.
She's questioning his authority.
Down with the patriarchy, sister.
Mm-hmm. Or just with people who claim to be an expert on something. Maybe it's okay to do your own research.
Do your own research.
Go to Bing. Type in Google.
Google and Bing, down with the patriarchy.
Microsoft is going to like revoke my Office 365 subscription just on that alone. Okay.
All right. So she gets away from Creepy Fawn, but she hasn't exactly been, she's not totally lined up for her second task yet.
Oh, that was the thing. Ophelia, the pillar in the middle of, at the very bottom of this winding stairways, there's a pillar and the Fawn says, that's you and me. And she asks, what about the baby? And he just changes the subject.
Yeah. He didn't want her to talk about that baby because gosh, is there any baby in this movie yet so far? I mean, not quite yet, but like kinda. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who maybe it's meaning something.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the end of the scene between Ophelia and the fawn. And then they show villagers being given food rations.
Mm-hmm.
And
out of the barn.
Yeah, out of their handing it out.
This is the bread of Spain.
This is proof that nobody is going hungry because we're giving you a loaf of bread a day because that's all a man needs to survive is a loaf of bread a day.
Yeah, this is a hoagie sized loaf of bread, by the way. It was not satisfying looking in any way.
For Americans in the 2000 era, which is, I mean, food isn't exactly scarce for myself. I could eat a hoagie for a meal.
Yeah.
Preferably with some meat.
Maybe some rabbit. Communist.
Hey, got that rabbit because I have sick people back at home.
Oh, yeah? Anyways. Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Anyway, so
grabs the wine bottle. Advances slowly.
Okay. So as they're giving out food rations, Ophelia goes into the bathroom where her book is being hidden, and she opens it up, and all she sees is a bloody uterus, which you pointed out.
Looks a bit like a fawn.
Yeah.
Because it's got it spirals to the left and the right at the top, and then it comes down together. But she's also been told that this book can tell the future. So she knows it's going to give her the things she needs to do, but she also knows that it's going to, you know, and I'm going to say something I just said 5 seconds, she's going to tell her the future. So she's like, what's happening? And then it turns into this bloody thing. Immediately, you hear a scream from the other room.
Yeah, and she runs through, drops the book, and she sees her mom just in pain, asking for help. And Ophelia goes out and gets the captain.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the only thing that she ever really asks him for in the entire movie. Most of the time, if she needs something, someone else gives it to her. She wants something, she takes it from him. But their exchange, this is like the only moment in the movie where their exchange is like later on, you see them sitting outside the room, both in the hall, and it's kind of like a dire moment.
Well, in the moment she goes to get the captain, right, he is immediately triggered because the son is the biggest thing to him. This is the acquisition of a male child is paramount to anything else in his life, and it probably has to do with the screwed up relationship with his dad, and there's probably watch involved, and that's all crazy. But she went to him because he was the highest authority she could think of in a moment of tragedy. So it's probably like the only instances where they would have both had some mutual need for each other.
Right. But she's also building more of a relationship with Mercedes. But Mercedes isn't the person that she goes to. She goes straight to the captain, even though I think her mom asked to go get the doctor.
No, she just says, Ophelia, help me.
Oh, yeah.
That's all she says because mm-hmm. she's drenched in blood, like crazy amounts of blood.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, I don't think the doctor was in residence yet. Like, this is just before he decides to hole up with them. She had to go to the highest authority. Mercedes couldn't do anything, not to her knowledge anyway.
Right. It makes sense. Okay, and what I noted was that there's this blood in the book, there's red in the book, there's the red blood on her mom, and as they're passing out the bread, they're saying things like, the red lies. And I thought that was really interesting, like in this whole scene, there's like three instances of red, and then how the people in authority who are not someone that you would necessarily want to be on the side of are saying the red lies, but we see the two times before, it's actually it's very, very evident that it's not lying. The book didn't lie. Her mom, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, I could see how the dialogue would really have a juxtaposition to the facts, the visual facts that we're seeing.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But then the doctor shows up. He's like, she's on bed rest. She needs to have, like, she's going to be sedated. She's going to be in bed. Ophelia can't sleep with her anymore.
And Ophelia has her Harry Potter moment, as you put it.
I put it as Harry Potter because, reading directly from my notes, I blame movies for my love of odd sleeping quarters, attics, barns, cupboards under the stairs, and fern gullies.
You slept in a fern gully?
I mean, haven't we all? Didn't you want to? You remember Fern Gully?
I do remember Fern Gully. I like the idea.
Why should I worry? Why should I care?
That's not the song I think about when I think of Fern Gully.
It's Oliver and
Co. Good movie, though. Good movie. I was actually thinking of Tim Curry doing ta, Toxic Love.
Oh, I love that song.
That was a good one.
The one that it's Shout. I think she sings Shout with them.
I don't remember.
No, dude sings Shout. Guy with the 90s mullet.
Yeah.
Like the dark sideburns, but the bleached top.
Oh, that's right. The mullet was still a thing in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
But as long as it's shaggy and... Okay, sorry. So, I've only seen Oliver and Company like once. I can't believe I've... But it's the best song.
That is the best song.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mercedes comforts her in her attic bedroom. And my notes then say, want comforting? How about a terrifying melody?
You did not like this melody. I
liked it, but it was creepy. There was nothing comforting about it. She's like holding it. She's like, can you sing me a lullaby? And she's like, I only know one and I don't know the words. And she's like, I want to hear it anyway. And it's a very melodramatic moment for me. And she just holds her head and is just like, mm-hmm. And I'm like, no. First of all, no copyright infringement. That is not what it sounds like. But it's similar. It's just deep and tonal, and it changes notes or whatever that just makes it sound odd.
And then, let's see.
Oh, she's sleeping, right? I think that comes next. The fawn shows up.
Well, that's right. Okay, so they have the lullaby, and then Mercedes goes down to the kitchen, and she pulls something out from an open area of the kitchen.
Yeah, there's like a stone tile that she pulls up in the middle of the floor.
Mm-hmm. And she hears someone behind her. Turns out to be the doctor.
Lucky self.
Yeah. And so they go out into the woods and they are meeting up with sexy rebels.
Yeah.
Is this where you want to talk about the sexy rebels?
No, we already talked about the sexy rebels. Yeah. I mean, I could reiterate. So now they're in a firelit cave, which brown on brown, it's just the faces and the glittering eyes. It's very much like a...
Warm tones.
I'm just...
Very warm tones.
The crackling of the fire.
Pedro. Pedro. I mean, the actor that they got for him is very attractive.
Yeah.
And so it works on so many levels.
Well, it's how they trick you when you first see them. Have they gotten to reunite? No, this is like the second time maybe they've gotten to reunite. They like run up to each other.
No, this is the first time. This is the time where we realize, oh, that's not her sexy lover. It's just a sexy brother of hers.
Okay, so the doctor meets up with her and they're like, you ready to go? And she's like, yeah. So then they're walking up a stream to like hide their trail. That's another Hunger Games survival note. Walk mm-hmm. up a stream.
Yep.
And then they'll lose your scent trail.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Spaniards follow scent trails or they had any dogs or whatever that would do it either, but like...
But it's a...
Footsteps and... Smoochies.
Yeah.
Ground.
Mm-hmm. I mean, muddy ground.
If you're going to be walking along a stream, chances are there's going to be mud there. But we've already kind of seen that the area could very easily just be muddy with the way that Ophelia's shoes kind of pick up the dirt around the tree.
Over and over again. They just live in a mud bog.
Right. So it makes sense that they would know that they need to walk up the stream to avoid leaving shoe prints.
Right. So they meet up. Okay, so they get to a certain point in the stream. They're having this deep conversation. And then they turn and there's Pedro standing there in the sunlight. Sorry, we haven't gotten to the cave yet and I've already ranted about that little romantic moment, but she runs towards him all like, na, 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 na. They like embrace, and then you're like, oh, and she goes, mi hermano, which is my brother, and you're like, oh, I'm still okay with there not being a romantic bent on this, but
yeah,
it's a shame they wasted out possible makeout time with Pedro.
Another similarity between Mercedes and Ophelia is their relationship with their brother. Ophelia doesn't seem too bothered by the fact that her brother is technically fathered by another man. Mercedes and Pedro have a really good relationship. So there's a lot of similarities between Ophelia and Mercedes throughout the entire movie. This is just another one of them. Ophelia, even though her brother is fathered by another man, still sees him as her brother. She calls him my brother.
Yeah.
And Mercedes has this kind of same, you know, like she really cares about her brother as well.
They're trying to protect their sibling.
Right.
Like you see that love several times on both sides, making them two sets very much alike.
Right, right. And so there's still like a solid relationship. I like to think that if Ophelia hadn't died, she probably would have a good relationship with her brother when he got older. Like somewhere in the back of my mind, I think, oh, Ophelia, you know, if she did survive, she would have been with the rebels. They probably would have taken her to be raised with her and her brother.
Yeah, and there's the connotations of like Mercedes would have been a fantastic mother to her.
Right, right.
Yeah, it would have been good.
Yeah. And so after they meet up, we cut to Ophelia's room where the Faun shows up and is like, why haven't you completed the second task?
Sorry, but my mother is so very sick.
Here's a mandrake root. Put it in some milk.
Yeah.
Some blood.
I wrote, Faun is just riddled with presents. This scene, he's just like, you get a piece of chalk. You get an hourglass. You get a mandrake root. Pour some milk on that. Get some blood on that. Put that under a bed. He's like Santa Claus.
Yeah, he's just like, look, we need to get this done. We need, like, I think at one point he's like, there's no reason for an excuse. The Faun is mirroring the captain in a lot of ways. Like, he's being demanding, ignoring the fact that Ophelia's mother is, like, dying, and this is an important figure to her. It kind of is like another reason that Ophelia has to be a little bit questioning about the motivations that the Faun has.
Yeah, because he's like, 3 days till the full moon. We got to get this business done. What do you need? Where can I throw my money at? You know, like...
He's like a dance mom.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways.
I wish I had a song to sing to that. All right.
Why should I worry?
I'll just take this dagger back. We haven't gotten to the dagger scene. You can just...
Oh, right in my eye.
Oh, man.
Okay.
So that we go back to the cave, and then this doctor who's been, like, talking to this old guy who we only ever really see for this scene, is just like, you're going to have to lose that leg.
Yeah.
And they have this very dramatic...
Right. We see Mercedes passing out, like, different things, like cheese and tobacco and brandy to different people. She has letters for people. Mm. And one of the people in the cave is a soldier who stutters. And he's trying to read from a paper about, you know, some of this different stuff that's going on during the time. So then we get to this again, like, gory. Like, why did you need to show that?
You know, I thought it was tasteful because all they did, because the guy's trying to give mercy to this guy who's got gangrene or whatever going on in his sticky leg.
It's not a bottle to the face.
It's not a bottle to the face. It is a mercy. It's just that it's going to be a painful mercy.
And the guy is just like, I need a moment. A funny joke.
No,
it's a very serious scene. Seriously, no, we're taking this seriously.
No, are we taking any of this seriously? Okay. Oh, it was not a good joke. I said, I need a minute because after this, I won't have a leg to stand on. it's just a pause and he looks at him. He looks at him and then he gives the slight nod. And then, the doctor just does one good
So he goes through all of the flesh at the front of his lower leg. You hear the blade get to bone. And unfortunately, that's when the work starts in terms of amputation. So, like, you know, they're about to go through it.
Yeah, you see the blade piercing through the skin. And it's not like a simple cut. It is like a knife, a hot knife through butter.
It sounded and looked like if you're cutting through a baguette and you only get, like, it's a very stiff bread. You got it like a serrated knife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So similar. But he could only get in like half an inch, and it's like, and it is not pleasant. And it's right. Good that they cut away then.
Oh no. Yet another amputation of Plotter. From Wallace's leg in Tusk to a campaigner's nose in Batman Returns to this dank new cut. We at Shocked and Applaud have been letting loose ends be a thing for a while. Did you expect anything different in part two of our review of Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth? Hey, this is your audio engineer and rebel scum, Jonathan, thanking you for continuing down our rabbit hole of off-colored commentary, adventurous analysis, and why not? 90s cartoon callbacks. It may not be obvious, but this show still has a leg left in this game. And as it turns out, that leg is someone you know. It's you, you long, luxurious appendage you. We are an uninterrupted show because, firstly, editing is hard, and secondly, we have our monthly applauder patrons to echo our laughter. Visit shockedandapplaud.com or search for us on Patreon for more details on how you can directly support the show. As always, you can find us on Twitter at ShockedApplaud, Facebook at ShockedAndApplaud, or email us at ShockedAndApplaud@gmail.com. Share with others and let us know your favorite parts of our rants, reviews, and rebel yells. We're not out of the woods yet. Stay with us next week for the final part of our review of this brutally fantastic foreign film. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.